Strong is brought to you by Blickman Engineering, home of the Riptide. Visit them online at blickmanengineering.com.
Brewers, it's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters.
Greetings, cretins.
You know, John, the other day, I realized that I am not a winking person.
Oh, really?
I am not a winker. I see people, you know, wink, and it looks really cool. You know, they kind of do
that thing, yeah. Things,
you know, and, you know, they say something, something funny to somebody, and then they give them a wink. And I don't know, maybe it's my squinty eyes. Maybe it's just, I don't have the personality to pull it off. I think it's very difficult. Are you a winker, John?
Yeah, I can be. Actually, I'm more of the Spock eyebrow kind of thing.
Yes.
But I can separately wink each eye.
Uh-huh.
And
that's good. That's probably in the neurological tests that they do.
Yeah,
when they've
yeah.
seen if you have suffered a stroke. It's probably one of those things.
Yeah. Yep. Learned it specifically for that. Yeah.
And
preventative, proactive, you know.
You know who I imagine probably uses the wink quite well?
Ah, our good friend John Blickman, I imagine.
Yes. I imagine, you know, he's probably, you know, comes up with some brilliant engineering idea to improve your brew day.
Uh-huh.
And he releases this information to his team and follows it up by a wink. I bet he does. He can pull it off. He's got the brain power and the ability to make that happen. So if for nothing else, that he's a great winker, I would urge you to check out BlickmanEngineering.com and send a email to our good friend, John Blickman, feedback@BlickmanEngineering.com. Tell him how much you appreciate that he pays for the show so you don't have to. Maybe next time you see him, give him a nice wink, of acknowledgement that he's done the show.
We should specify wink, not wank, just to be clear.
I said very clearly he's a winker.
That's right.
Yeah. I did not say wanker. I don't know where you got that from. I said he's a winker. Well, and also not a wanker. Ryan Burke is with us. He's the head
the greatest cider. Introduction I've ever received.
The head cider maker and head of research and development at Angry Orchard. Ryan, do you ever wink at people
I have the physical ability to wink, but I wouldn't say that I, on average, wink.
Okay.
I actually prefer to close both eyes and just sort of nod out.
Right.
Very good.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I saw somebody on TV the other day, like, winking after something. I thought, well, that person really has got the wink down. I just realized over the course of, 59 years, I really have not utilized the wink. And it's maybe a physical limitation I have. I don't know.
You and Rocket Raccoon. Yeah.
Well, Ryan, we got you here today because we wanted to talk about cider. We wanted to, you started out something a long time ago. How did you get started in cider?
Yeah, I...
There's lots of cider jokes, too.
Yeah.
My amateur career started quite a long time ago. Yeah. Where I come from, which is Williamson, New York, is a little town sort of equidistant from Syracuse and Rochester.
Good apple country.
It isn't. Yeah, it's not much more than an apple orchard that feeds the Mott system. So if you're familiar with Mott apple, everything that's actually the primary factory is located in Williamson, where I grew up. It was also a dry town from Prohibition until the 2000s. So a lot of illicit cider making has gone on there. I guess not so illicit now that it's legal. But growing up, there was just a lot of cider making traditions that you might, let's say, were discoverable for interested youths.
So you started making cider as a teen?
Yeah. Well, I'm not supposed to say that on record.
Right.
Want to encourage that kind of thing, but like I said, interested parties could figure it out.
As long as you didn't drink it, it's fine.
Right. Yes. As long as you didn't drink it or taste it, you could certainly make it.
It is just experimentation at that point.
That's right. So I was aware of it as a drink. It certainly wasn't at Williamson Senior High School. They didn't talk about how this might be a career path. Mm-hmm. But in college, I've discovered homebrewing. And eventually I landed in Chicago. I did a lot of work with Slow Food out there, and through that work, I met Greg Hall as he was exiting Goose Island, and he was starting Virtue Cider, and I did all the early fermentation work there as a law student. And then Greg asked me to come on as a cider maker, and eventually the head cider maker, and I ran that program for about 5 years until I came over to Angry Orchard.
So it sounds like, at least to me, you could be talked into doing just about anything. Go to law school.
Yeah.
Slow food. Yeah. Cider.
Yeah. I tried it out. Yeah. I tried law school out. It ultimately wasn't for me, and I didn't know that until I went to Chicago and I kind of got involved in the communities that I got involved in. And I'm lucky to have been in a community where homebrewing was like such a big deal, and we were, at least in the circles I was running in. And we had this really like competitive homebrew group. We threw these parties, which were certainly illegal, via the chef named Juan Kim. And he would cook, and we would all come, and we would all bring our best stuff, and we would a lot of camaraderie, but a lot of competition, and we would sell tickets. It was kind of like a homebrew rave. And we did get in a little bit of trouble here and there. But eventually everybody in that group, has gone on to either start their own brewery, open their own restaurant, or make cider, one person, me. and or work in the brewing industry in some way. So it really was like my formative years, kind of building taste. And, you know, Chicago is just such an awesome homebrew scene. It's such an active homebrew scene. And, mm-hmm. Goose Island is a big, big part of that. They've, always kept their doors open. Having Siebel there has always been a driver. So there's just a lot of excitement around it. And I was just lucky to get involved with that group. And ultimately I was like, wow, I'm doing the wrong fucking thing. I need to get out of this. Can I swear on this?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. That's good, 'cause I swear a lot. So yeah, I just realized this is the wrong path, and I'm going to do this. And I was lucky to find a way out. And that was Virtue.
Very cool. Very cool.
Well, and, you mentioned, making beer, making cider. Did you ever make wine, mead, any of that stuff?
Mead. Come on. Don't insult me. Yeah, I've done a little bit of wine here and there. Nothing that I would be, proud to show you. We do in Walden and Angry Orchard, we do some grape and cider co-fermentation stuff that's fun.
Makes sense.
And certainly I still like keep my hand in doing beer stuff. We've done a lot of beer collaborations over the years and continue to do that work.
Beer cider collaboration?
Yeah, we did a collab with Side Project out in St. Louis. We've done something with Crooked Stave, which we have yet to release. Yep.
But that
yeah, good. I mean, for me, it's just like collaboration work is about friendship. And a lot of these guys have been a part of my life for a long time. I've always been kind of close to the beer scene. Spent a lot of time up at Hill Farmstead with Sean. He's a good friend of mine. So I sort of like, I don't really like to put limits on what we can do. And I'm more interested in like exploring the personal relationships and the people that like get me fired up and get me excited and think about things either the way I do or in a completely different way and find ways to do really like personal collaborative work, not just like no phone in shit, you know, like, yeah, throw this in. Okay. But
yeah,
you know, in the case, you know, for instance, of side project, I shipped a bin of apples out from New York to St. Louis, and then I flew out there, and I met up with Corey, and we did we ordered a hand crank mill off of Amazon, and I sat there and hand cranked an entire bin of apples, crab apples, so like this big, off our farm. I mean, all day long, just absolute hell. But it was a blast, and ultimately the beer was, you know, was awesome. So, yeah, I mean, we've done, you know, collaborations with coffee roasters, brewers, cider makers, winemakers, no mead, for all the mead friends out there. Sorry.
Well, that's the best part of collaboration, exactly like you described it, is, you know, the fact that, you know, it's supposed to be a collaborative effort with your friends, you know, something that challenges you, you know, mentally, maybe even physically. You know, you're making something that you would never make before versus just kind of repeating. I every once in a while I get somebody that's trying to get me to do a collaboration for marketing purposes. It would be good because, you know, X, Y, and Z. I'm like, I don't know those people. I'm not going to do it. If I don't respect what you're already making, if I don't like you as a person, then, you know, there's no way it's going to happen. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't care.
The world doesn't need another collaboration. So it should always be, you know, if you're going to introduce one, in my view, it should always be really personal and interesting that way. It has to be like beyond the marketing, even beyond the, you know, beyond what's in the bottle or in the keg. I think it's, you know, I each one of the collaborations we've done over time is something that I've like really learned from. You know, in the case of this coffee collaboration we did, I end up in Costa Rica at a coffee selection. You know, like what? I would have never. Nice. That's never a thing I thought I would get to say. And I mean, this industry is just like so amazing that way. Where, you know, over time I've met this roaster who, you know, has become a really good friend of mine. Who ultimately, you know, was like, hey, why don't we take this one step further and go to the actual place where we get this from, and you can meet the grower and be a part of a cupping, and you know what? It's unreal. Sort of like drive down to the source on something like that. I mean, that's life changing, right? And I'll tell that story for the rest of my life.
Oh,
and now I know this family in Costa Rica who I'm in communication with. You know, I mean, those are the kinds of things that I think are really valuable when it comes to collaborating.
It's the coolest thing about, you know, this space of, you know, craft, I guess, you know, craft beer, craft coffee, craft cider, craft, you know, it's a mentality and a, you know, way of living that, you know, gets you to travel. And when you do travel, you get to meet people and do interesting things, and it extends out, and it has this resonance through life that's just beautiful. You know, it's no wonder you left law school to something more not that law school can't and you know, being an attorney can't have wonderful repercussions for society and the world, but it's just a kind of a different feel, I think.
I agree. Yes. Yeah. I'm glad it worked out this way.
You and I both. All right. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to have more with Ryan Burke from Angry Orchard right after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking with Ryan Burke, the head cider maker and head of research and development at Angry Orchard, longtime cider maker, home brewer as well. When you were first making cider, you mentioned Mott's and all that, and the supply there. When I first made cider, I've got what we call Apple Hill near here, where you can drive up and get fresh pressed cider and all this. But my first cider was made with, I think, a frozen treetop concentrate, and it actually turned out pretty good. And I think I won an award with that stuff. Do you have to, to harvest your own apples and crush them and press them, or can you make a passable cider just off of some juice?
Yeah, for sure. I think, at the simplest level, every apple can be turned into cider. It's a simple sugar. It's going to make itself whether you do it or not. I think that, I always keep that in mind. I think that it can give returns that are kind of boring to a home cider maker without a lot of access to interesting fruit. So while every single apple is fermentable, not every single apple gives you something that like makes you excited or like delivers a really interesting finished cider. So, for me, I'm always looking for apples that have some level of tannin and, increased acidity and et cetera, et cetera. So the average grocery store type apple that you might get at the mill or at the grocery store or at the farmer's market, it's not that you can't make good cider out of it. I think ultimately it begins a quest for more. And that could be other, like looking for these apple varieties, or it could be looking to adjuncts, and that's when people start putting hops in their cider or raisins or, whatever you might put in there to like make something a little more exciting. And I think that's cool. I mean, cider is a category with it has, we have an association that attempts to make categories and all that. And that's great and informative for the drinker. But what I think is cool about it is it's almost serves in the sort of cocktail space where you can kind of do anything. You can kind of add anything you want to do to make it exciting. You could bring into the mix. So, I think, yes, with the right fermentation and the right yeast, you can make something really interesting and good to drink out of the most basic of apples, except for the Red Delicious. That apple is not a good apple to make cider out of, but it's not delicious. It's a deceptive name.
Yeah. Well, what do you look for in a cider apple?
Yeah, so quote unquote cider apple, another way to say that is a bittersweet or a bitter sharp apple. That's an apple that has some level of tannin in it, bitters meaning tannin. You'll find that in crab apples too, some crab apples. I often want some of that. Usually not, no one apple has everything that you want. So a bittersweet apple is going to have tannin and sugar, but not a lot of acid. So then I'm going to have to look somewhere else for some acidity. Now there are a couple apples out there that have it all, but they're hard to come by. It's cool to make single variety stuff, but I like to look around and pull character from different places. So it's a balance of kind of three things, some amount of acidity, some amount of tannin, and then sugar to make alcohol. So okay. I'm always sort of playing around in those three spaces.
Do cider apples and pineapples have a bit in common in terms of the characters you're looking for?
A lot of the like pie apples, like for instance, will be like Northern Spy is one of those apples. It's a New York State variety. Actually founded a few towns over from where I grew up. So it's something that I'm particularly proud of, that apple. And we use a lot of it in Walden. And often that apple has been used for pie because it stands up. It's a hearty apple, right? It's got a length.
Yeah.
And so it's an apple that, one, I could leave on the tree for a lot longer than other apples. And it'll continue to improve. I can put it in cold storage. It'll stick around for a while because it's just a sturdy apple. It's got a lot of length, and it used to be a very popular apple for the eating industry before, like, cold storage is what it is today, where you can store an apple for, you know, 18 months. It used to be an apple you could store it just in your barn, you know, for 4 or 5 months into the springtime. And we do that now. Yeah, so those kind of apples generally do have some added interesting character, preservative qualities. It might have some tannin and some high level of acidity, which allows it to last a little bit longer, the same way it allows the cider to last a little bit longer in the bottle as far as like aging it goes.
Okay.
So are you guys growing your own apples? And a follow-on question, why is the orchard angry? Does that help the flavor?
I just can't escape that question, can I? yes. Yeah, I mean, we are growing apples on our farm. So Walden is a 60-acre orchard. Take away the space that's the cider house and parking and whatever. There's about 40-odd acres that are planted. And then we also are growing some apples up in the Finger Lakes with some partner growers. After that, that's like the largesse of our own orcharding. Almost all of that gets consumed at Walden. Some of it goes into our national flagship, Angry Orchard Crisp. As far as the fruit that we use for the rest of our production, like our national production that you find in the store, that's either grown in France or Pacific Northwest, and to some extent in New York State.
Now, you mentioned earlier crab apples. I've also read that, you know, some of the ugliest apples are the apples that are abused in the orchard, the ones that not getting, you know, as much water or whatever, are actually better cider apples because the sugar content's different or the flavor develops differently. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Can, yeah. It speaks more to the fact that we don't need our fruit to look pristine on a grocery store shelf. So that industry expects a pristine apple that appears to be wrapped in plastic and sometimes is wrapped in plastic. And that's consumer, that's what the grocery store shopper, kids lunchbox filler expects. We as cider makers don't have to meet those needs. No one really sees our apples, right? They just see the finished product. So we don't have the same inputs as it relates to like farming. So we can, a lot of the inputs, a lot of the you know, spray, any kind of application you might put on the tree during the season, a lot of that is for the sake of the grocery store. And since we don't have to do that, we can kind of skip a lot of inputs. And therefore sometimes and often the apples themselves, you know, they don't look pristine. They look a little more ugly. And yeah, for a lot of reasons, they're better apples for cider making.
Jason asks, thoughts about the graph style, 49% apples, 51% wort. Hops. Yeah. Will it be a style that brewers latch on to?
Geez, the cider we have coming up with Crooked Stave is sort of in that space. I think it's cool. I think it, you know, it kind of brings beer. I like things that blend the lines, right? And so for me, a beer that is like a wine, I would say, is like a like lambic style beer, right? So can we take a lambic style beer and blend it with apple juice and do a fermentation that way and like get it even closer to into that wine space? well, I guess Cider Space in this case, but yeah, I think it's cool. I think it, I think it elevates the beer in the right situation.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever, you know, one of the things that I was told as far as apple making is, you know, or cider making is, you know, there's perry, but also, you know, the possibility of adding some pears to an apple cider because the natural residual sweetness of a pear adding to the fullness of an apple cider.
Yeah. I mean, pears sometimes often have unfermentable sugars in them. So, you know, a cider apple or an apple has zero unfermentable sugars. And so, yeah, if you want to have something that's naturally sweet without adding anything back, that is more or less stable without any kind of pasteurization or sulfite adding or anything like that, then pears are a good way to go. Definitely recommended. Most of the pears that you can get your hands on, you know, are pretty basic. Like grocery store pears, apples or grocery store pears. They're not like perry pears that are, I mean, even as a cider maker with means, I can hardly get my hands on those. And like, trust me, if they're out there, I'm getting my hands on them before everyone else. And everyone else feels that way too. You know, I mean, they're so hard to come by. The great perry pears. And so in my total career, I've made perry from perry pears in America only 3 times. And in the case of Walden, we actually get them from Oregon. So we almost buy it. Almost all of our fruit comes from New York and the Northeast. But we work with a grower named Kevin, who has a cider brand called Easy Orchards, which any of your listeners have access to his cider. For my taste, is some of the best cider in the world. But he's also an expert grower, and he grows a few perry pears, and I'm able to get like a couple hundred gallons of it every other year, I guess it's been. So yeah, we didn't get any this year. We did get some last year. It's just they're so hard to grow. It's such a rare commodity. I basically would do anything for perry. It is like the next thing I would love to just totally dive into and grow a ton of perry pears.
Huh. If what percentage of pear juice would you add to a cider just as kind of like a baseline to make it interesting?
Yeah, probably. I mean, maybe just 10% of a blend would probably be enough. Okay. I personally, if I was making it at home, you know, I'd probably be after like in making an interesting, like drier cider. So, I mean, you start going up from 10%, 20%, you'll have a medium sweet cider. So somewhere in that space,
I think 10 to 20. Cool.
Yeah. And, you know, from my perspective, I think, you know, a slow and cold managed fermentation when it comes to cider is really important. And especially on the home side, it's another one of those things where I've been around for as long as I have and judged as many competitions as I've judged and interacted with so many people just around like home cider making. One of the things, you know, and I hear of people feeling bad about their fermentations and like having failures and then sort of abandoning it because it sucks. That's something that I really want people to be able to avoid, because like that home cider maker is where the next cider maker is. And we want to pull for those people that are like, as an industry, people that are really excited and working on something cool at home. And so if I could advocate for anything for a home cider maker is to have some kind of temperature control, because cider just isn't beer. And one, stay away from beer yeast. And two, control your fermentation temperature. You know, if you got to build out, you know, a chest freezer, which is what I would recommend and have done. I actually still have my homebrew chest freezer in my basement right now. And, you know, in a temperature control on that. So you can ferment, you know, around 60 degrees Fahrenheit instead of, you know, 75 and above. That's where you're going to start getting a lot of off flavors, off aromas. I feel like cider is a really delicate medium. and it requires a little bit, it just requires a little bit more attention to detail on the fermentation temp and speed. And this is, you know, folk science, although I have some real science I could show you too, but folk science around, hey, look, if you slow things down and you're delicate with it, you're going to get more out of it on the other side. You're going to get more aroma. You're going to get more body and mouth feel. It just lends to a better finished cider to slow things down a little bit.
I've heard that colder cider fermentation, better aromatics, better body. And one of the things might be just, you know, rapid evolution of CO2 scrubs a lot of aromatics out of whatever you're fermenting.
Oh, 100%.
On the flip side, you're probably trapping more sulfur in there. But you know, it's a balancing act. What sort of yeast do you recommend for cider making?
Yeah, so I like, I like to not pitch any yeast at all. Is my favorite way to go uh-huh. things.
Natural.
If you're not quite ready for that yet, I think that neutral wine yeasts are really nice. In particular, if you have some apples with a little bit of character, you really want to showcase that. You don't want to showcase the yeast so much. I'll look for a white wine yeast that can tolerate some cold and is going to lend mid palate body. And I say that because a lot of the apples the average home cider maker can get their hands on are probably the average grocery store apples or somewhere around that. Or maybe if you live in like New Hampshire, then that's different. But on average, you know, that's the case. And so you want to find something that's going to bring that middle up because it's kind of the thing that's missing. Mm-hmm. You're probably not going to have a lot of fruit with tannin and body. So if you can find a yeast that helps assists mid palate weight, then, you know, and those yeasts are out there, they're easy to find. And, you know, again, something that'll tolerate a little bit of a colder temperature is great. And that's my go-to. In fact, even in Walden, when we do pitch yeast, that's generally the kind of thing we're looking for. If you can find apples that have, you know, tannin in them, then there's like the red wine yeast that are there to help boost that robustness. And we use those kinds of yeast too. We don't use any like quote unquote cider yeast. So only wine yeast and never brewing yeast.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about nutrients?
Nutrients are really important. You know, we use organic nitrogen. That's what I recommend. You can easily get that as a home cider maker. I rely on that and I rely on oxygen. Right after, you know, when the fermentation starts, I kind of wait and watch for it. If I'm a home cider maker and I'm in the simplest setup, I'm like waiting to see some bubbles. As soon as I see some bubbles, I'm putting in some organic nitrogen and I'm getting some oxygen in there somehow.
Do you have a dosage rate that you'd recommend people start with?
From a nutrient standpoint?
Yeah.
Honestly, this is unscientific. Whatever the recommendation is, it's usually for wine. Mm. I usually, because I want to move slowly, because you throw in a bunch of nitrogen, you're immediately
going to
kick the fermentation up. So I usually, without reading your packet of yeast nutrient, mm-hmm. I would do half of the recommended dose.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. I can tell you this, at Virtu, right when we got going, you know, didn't have the lab set up. We were a really small crew. We were just trying to like get it done. And, mm-hmm. and that's what we were doing with ciders that we were putting out to the market that was distributed in like, you know, 30 states or whatever it was, 15 states. We were just like, all right, we didn't have glycol at the time. So it was like, all right, how are we going to do this right, but slow it down?
Mm-hmm.
Half the yeast nutrient. Mm-hmm. So that's you can put that on my gravestone, half the yeast nutrient.
Well, I have a question. I mean, you say organic nitrogen. To me, that sounds like urea or
Wow. Is that what you mean, or you know, were we talking about different other compounds?
I mean, it's yeast hull, yeast hull based. Yeah. Okay. So I mean, you know, not a shameless plug. We use Scott Labs Lelemon. That's, I think you can get little packets of Lelemon too. And it's, they have a product called Fermade O. It's just organic yeast hull.
Okay.
Yep.
So not ammonium nitrate or something like that.
No. And so one of the reasons, aside from the fact that it's organic nitrogen, I like to use it because if you were to look at how it doles itself out across the fermentation, instead of one big bang, it actually is a nice arc. And so I'll pitch it right when I see those bubbles with some oxygen, and it'll be a nice arc and kind of drop off rather than a big hit. So the yeast don't explode. They sort of continue to work slowly. And then let's say the Play-Doh, I speak in bricks, it's about the same as Play-Doh. Let's say you start at 14 Play-Doh, you know, somewhere around between 10 and 8, probably closer to 8 Play-Doh, you want to do another hit of nitrogen and oxygen. And then after that, you're keeping oxygen out of the situation, right? That's like, then you're going to, after that, it's going to absorb as much oxygen you put in. Your fermentation's still going. It'll do another nice little arc, not a big hit. And you'll want to keep oxygen down. It'll absorb all that oxygen, no oxidation. But you'll want to be careful from that point on. Oxygen, you know, more or less becomes your enemy at that point.
Now, are you doing a half dose each time for a total of a dose, or
always?
So, and you're doing a quarter and a quarter.
A half and a half. And I still do that today. I still, every cider that I make in Walden, I do it that same exact way. It served me well. I also, if anyone's interested in getting into natural and wild fermentations, I do it that way too. I won't pitch yeast, and I'll watch for my fermentations to start. And then I will treat my wild yeast the same way I treat a pitched yeast.
Very interesting.
Sean asks, I noticed finished cider has a slight sulfur smell. Why is that?
Well, not all finished cider. Some, I mean, it's hard to really answer that question without tasting or smelling
right.
the exact
what it
cider.
Is, right? Mm-hmm.
But there's a couple things that it could be. I mean, for instance, I'm smelling and drinking this cider that has zero sulfur. You know, so it is a thing people say. It can come from a few things. One, someone could have just put too much damn sulfur in their right. bottle and right. packaging, right. Which is totally possible and probably likely. I don't know if something can be probably likely, but you know what I mean.
probably.
So, yeah. It could be that. It also could be, I mean, you mentioned it sort of briefly there, you know, hydrogen sulfide is another thing that can happen when the fermentation is too cold or too sluggish. So it could be one of those two things. I avoid that sulfur note like the plague, and I considered it a flaw. And if I, you know, if I find it in a cider that we've made at Angry Orchard, then it goes down the drain.
Well, I would say, you know, homebrew wise, if you got a keg of it, seems a little sulfury, you could bubble some CO2 through and try and drive it off a little bit. You know,
for sure. You absolutely can. And I did say, you know, oxygen is your enemy, but actually in this case, it can be a positive. I mean, there is a point at which, you know, you get reductive character, which is, you know, sort of smells like baby diaper. You want to avoid that too. And one of the things that I've learned over time is that even though I believe oxygen in mass is my enemy, I find after fermentation, when I'm racking, it's better to let oxygen around, not all over the place, but let's say I'm not gonna flush my lines with CO2, for instance, because when I, especially in a natural fermentation, a wild fermentation, something that I've fermented for a long period of time or has had extended lees contact, when I rack it, I'll let a little oxygen in there because it stirs things up, it blows things off, and I leave some of that sulfur character in the background, which actually further answers the listener's question. You know, time is your friend. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people will treat cider like beer in the sense that they, and I don't mean all beer, but let's say an IPA, you know, you ferment it, you do your hop work, and then you package it almost immediately. It's very quick. You know, you have a turnaround that's a couple weeks, maybe less. Cider really enjoys a little bit of time hanging out. Things come back together. It's a very delicate process. It likes time. And so if you can, as a home cider maker, take your time on the other side. I mean, let's be honest, there's no rush here. Unless it's like competition time or something and you're trying to get it in, well, you should have planned better. Sorry. Especially if I'm judging, because if I smell sulfur on your cider, I'm going to mark you down, you know, it's going to be marked down and it'll be against you on a score. So like, take your time, right? There's no rush here. And a lot of that sulfur character that gets captured in the package blows away in the carboy. So let it, you know, give it some time, let it do its thing. Come back to it and then package it.
There you go. All right, let's take a short break. When we come back, I want to hear about a lot of the ciders you make that a lot of people may never have heard about. We'll be back right after this.
Are you looking for a simple brewing system that's great for all grain brewing, but everything on the market seems to be full of compromises? Blickman Engineering has the answer. The Blickman Brew Easy All Grain Brewing System. The Brew Easy is a complete system with easy upgrades and a beautiful compact design, perfect for any size brewing location. At its core, the Brew Easy is built on two gorgeous Blickman Boilermaker brew kettles, a high temperature March pump, and either a top tier gas burner or the new boil coil electric heater. The Brew Easy adapter lid allows the pots to stack on top of each other, forming an efficient, strong, and compact brewing setup that comes in 5, 10, and 20-gallon batch sizes. Upgrade your BrewEasy system with full automated control by adding a Blickman Tower of Power temp controller and make moving around easy with the Blickman Kettle Cart. The BrewEasy is modular. If you already own a Boilermaker kettle, you can build your BrewEasy by purchasing just the modules you need. The new BrewEasy all-grain brewing system. See it today at BlickmanEngineering.com and brew with Blickman quality on your new BrewEasy. Easy.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. I wanted to tell you about my good friends, Josh and RJ at Brew Chatter, brewchatter.com. It's a really nice homebrew shop just outside of Reno in Sparks, Nevada. And they've got everything you want to make a great cider there. They can help you. They even got the stuff to crush it and press it, and they got all that stuff there. They've got all the different yeasts. They've got books. They got a lot of knowledge. And most importantly, they're just super nice guys that want to see us be successful. So check them out, brewchatter.com. If you go down there, say hi to Josh and RJ for me as well. All right. Before the break, we were talking about the types of ciders you guys make. You guys make, you know, a lot of people are familiar with Angry Orchard and the array of ciders you make there. But you also make, you know, naturally, spontaneously fermented, you know, ciders. You've got barrel aged. You got a whole array of things. Tell us about some of those.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, our project in Walden is, you know, relatively new in the scope of the brand. We bought the property that we're at in 2014. We opened the doors in 2015. It's in the middle of a 60-acre orchard, like I mentioned before. And so we're surrounded by apples. And so I just, like, when I first saw the property, the first thing I thought is, okay, this isn't any different than what Cantillon once was in the middle of a cherry orchard, right? We're in the exact same place. Well, not exact same, but same idea. And so I came into it already being very heavily influenced by English cider making traditions. Tom Oliver of Oliver Cider in Hereford, UK, is one of my closest friends, but also a mentor of mine. Actually, I'm drinking this collab cider we did, what we do year on year, over in the UK. And I really just like, I love expression of terroir. I love what it means to be in and of a place. So to have, the opportunity to really express that at Walden has been like, I mean, this is my life's work, right? At Virtue, we did a lot of natural and wild fermentation. So I came into it. I came into Angry Orchard with a lot of work, a lot of time put against those ideas. But we weren't a working orchard. We were in farmland, farm country, but, you know, we weren't surrounded by an orchard in the same way that we are in New York. And so, you know, right out the gate, everything we did in Walden was zero pitch. In year one, we built, I mean, we built this barn, right? We built the cider house. So instead of opening up and pitching yeast, we pitched zero yeast. So in our first vintage, 2015, we didn't use a single lab produced yeast. Everything was natural. We opened the windows up. So our cellar is a big octagon. We opened all the windows up and just went ahead and did all our fermentations naturally. And so we really
open fermenters.
Well, we don't, but we don't need to because we don't have a hot side. So apples come in off the orchard, we press them. It's a cold process.
Right.
So nothing is killing off our yeast. So our press really is the point of contact. And so it just over time, I mean, you can clean it till you're dead. It's not, you're not going to, you know, you can't stop you can't stop the hustle.
And you're not worried about, you know, Joe Bob coming in out of the bathroom, got the stank finger, you know, perhaps didn't use enough paper and, you know.
Joe Bob can't get near my friend.
You know, Joe Bob's got to wear gloves or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we're very careful. We're pristinely clean. We definitely operate like brewers that way. You can eat off the floor in the cellar or you better be when I show up there tomorrow, we better be able to eat off the cellar. I'm a stickler on that stuff. It's very important to me. Our cellar is always pristine. By keeping our world very clean, I feel very comfortable to take what might be considered risks. But you know, this is my 11th season of cider production professionally. I feel pretty comfortable about like those risks. We don't really, with the right measures in place, we don't have a ton of failure. We certainly have some, but it isn't often.
Do you wait for a certain time in the season for harvesting and fermenting? Because, for example, you know, I know at Canton they wait for like 5 freezing nights. When we do something here, we wait for 3 freezing nights because we're in California and where we're located, 3 freezing nights are about as good as it's going to get. To kill down, you know, as much of the bacteria as possible that are on the apples or, I mean, how does that work? How do you time that out?
100%. Yeah, we do. And it's actually nice because it not always in a perfect year. And let's just pretend that they're all perfect. They're definitely not. But in a perfect year, you know, we're harvesting late into October. We'll still be harvesting now, even into November, depending on the apple variety. So it's a cold process all the way through. Things are definitely tempered. I mean, our tanks, of course, are on glycol. We can keep things cool. Our oak program, some of it is in chilled rooms, some of it is not. So yeah, the colder temperatures are definitely important to us. And we really don't get going. Like we just started pressing this week when the temperatures are below 50 Fahrenheit during the day and they're dropping into the 30s at night. So yeah, that is important to this process. That's one of those things that we have in place as a process that allows us to then take, you know, again, what might be considered risks, but this is one of those ways we mitigate that kind of risk. Like the bacterial failure risk.
Right. Jason was asking, is there a drawback of bringing apple juice to a boil? I guess to he's asking to kill bacteria and wild yeast, but.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it if you want it. I mean, I assume he's trying to pasteurize the juice ahead of time. I don't really think you need to. I mean, if you're going to pitch a yeast against some apple juice, it's going to be a killer strain against whatever's in there. And mm-hmm. I mean, another thing that like if you think about cider from a brewing perspective, let's say it's better to not think about cider from a brewing perspective mm-hmm. because we don't have complex sugars. Mm-hmm. So most, not all, but most of the things that you might be worried about fucking your cider up, they're not going to have an opportunity to play because your primary sac is going to finish the fermentation and then that's it. I mean, unless you're, you know, adding sugar back and you have no way to stabilize, but I mean, you have a dry cider. It's not a real hospitable environment for anything except malolactic bacteria. And in my personal preference, I like a cider that goes through malolactic fermentation. So I don't avoid that. If mm-hmm. you're scared about that, and a lot of people are, then there's ways to stabilize your cider on the other side. So I don't think the extra step out front of boiling or bringing your cider to a boil, it doesn't really get you what you think it's going to get you. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Because just pitch the yeast and deal with it on the other side, not up front. I mean, unless like your cider is like, you know, some trash from some garbage mill and it's disgusting. I mean, then maybe don't ferment that stuff.
Your Bob's put a stank finger in and
yeah.
Ryan, now, I want to go back to the yeast question. I mean, when you talk about wild yeasts and the yeast that are naturally on the apples, mm-hmm. Are these Brettanomyces type yeasts or are they a different species?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly depends on where you are, what time of the year it is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's hard to like narrow that down. We actually have done, we've done trials where we plate the orchard at blossom and then we plate the orchard at harvest and then we ferment. And then we look at the fermentation and see, do we find the same things that we plated in the orchard actually in the finished cider, which has been, it's an ongoing project. All the results aren't in, we've got a lot more work to do, but it's something that like, I really want to like dedicate a lot of time to and try to write about, because I think it's an interesting, it's an interesting path. And so the answer to that is yes, we have seen, some sacro that we found in the orchard, like, you know, unbanked sacro out in the orchard that we then find in the cider. A lot of when we isolate those things, we'll find a lot of bacteria. Often we at our site are not finding Brett from the orchard. Certainly we have Brett in the cider house. I mean, it's just unavoidable.
Yeah. I always loved the sparkling cider that was created in the garage, you know, when I was a kid, just because the jug sat out there in cool temperatures and slowly became sparkling over time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in our homebrewing days, we've made ciders, we've pitched yeast, they've done, you know, natural fermentations that were very Brett-like, very, very barnyard. And sure. It's like, yeah, not what I was looking for in a cider.
No. Yeah, I mean, for me, it just depends on where it is. Like, and I mean that by like how excessive it is and then kind of where I'm drinking it, what the occasion is. So if I'm out in the West Country of England and, you know, at say, I'll just use Tom as an example, you know, his cider house he raises cattle and they've been raising cattle and sheep on this farm for, you know, generations. And, you know, you're going to smell some cow in some, not all the cider, but some of the cider that he does. His cider house that you can literally like be tasting a barrel and look out through the barn wall. That's, you know, you can see through the slats and look a cow dead in the face. So are you going to get Barnyard in that? Yeah, probably. And in that case, I find it appropriate and interesting. And he ferments for it and he blends for it. And so therefore, I find it to be nuanced and delicate and I probably already said appropriate, but appropriate for like that drinking time and that sure. moment. And then give me some cheese from that same farm or that same, I mean, and then like, you know, that's transcendent.
Yes.
But do I want to drink that, you know, sitting here talking to you? Probably not. It's probably not what I want to have in my glass right now. Although as it turns out, this is pretty funky.
Have you ever used enzymes in your cider making? Do you use pectic enzyme or anything like that?
I have. I don't generally. I'm not against it in any way. It makes a lot of sense. I have a certain luxury in my cellar that, you know, if I speak to a home cider maker who definitely doesn't, I would probably use it from a clarification standpoint. It makes a lot of sense. I prefer to take the luxury of time. And cold and let my ciders just slowly drop out. So the cider that we make in Walden, probably about 75% of the cider we make there is done this way. We make some cider that's, you know, clarified and sparkling and more like reminiscent of what you might find at the grocery store. But most of the cider we make is not. And those ciders will generally, at a minimum, will take a year to complete and up to 3 years to complete. Mm-hmm. And so in that time, I naturally clarify. I don't need to add any of that. And for me, stripping anything out is a negative. I mm-hmm. want it all. I want mm-hmm. it all in there. I want all the character. And the least amount of removal is the best for mm-hmm. that particular type of cider. It isn't always appropriate. And so when I make something, you know, we have like just standard, like our standard farm cider. It's actually we don't use enzymes in it, but I could see using enzymes in it. We don't use enzymes, period. But I'm not opposed to it. It makes a ton of sense. And I could see using it if I needed to, you know, I just don't need to, so I don't.
All right. One more short break. When we come back, I want to learn more about the barrel aged ciders you do.
Great.
We'll ask about that right after this.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. We're here with Ryan Burke, head cider maker at Angry Orchard and Walden. They do an amazing array of stuff. And one of the things I was curious about was your barrel-aged ciders. I mean, I love barrel-aged beers. You know, wines are barrel-aged, or most of them are. It just makes sense to barrel-age ciders. Do you barrel age a lot of them, or most of them are stainless?
We do a mix. So we have a couple different programs for oak. One of them is our bourbon barrel age program. So we have a cider called Wooden Sleeper. It is 100% bourbon barrel aged. And in that case, we're using older bourbon barrels. It's always important to think about cider in a delicate way, because it isn't beer and it isn't wine. It doesn't have the alcohol and the strength of acidity and tannin that wine does. It isn't beer. It doesn't have those complex sugars. It's very like bare naked. You know, you need to be really nice to it. Mm-hmm. And so we use older bourbon barrels. So like in the 9+ range. Everything we do there is at least 1 year of aging. And we do that in an evaporative way. So I know I mentioned oxygen is my enemy. When it comes to barrel aging, I feel a little bit different. Our house character is micro oxidative, and that's just a preference. It isn't necessarily the way it should be. It's the way I like things. So, and that's just from tasting, you know, cider around the world over time. And yeah, so that wooden sleeper will go into the barrel for at least 1 year, and up to 3 years. So each time we make it, the system gets older. So we'll do, you know, let's say we have 100 barrels, we'll take 20 out to blend, and the result, the remaining stuff gets older. And then a couple months later, we'll pull 20 more barrels out and it continues to get older, but then we'll start to backfill the system. So it's, and then everything is evaporative. So we never top anything off. So you get a little bit of like oxidative sort of sherry like character. And the cider's coming out around 10.5% alcohol. As it turns out, it's our most popular cider that we make at Walden. It hits kind of the beer guy bourbon barrel need. It's got, you know, kind of a higher alcohol. We sell it in little 187 cans. So it's like single serve can. It's a fun project. And we do a bunch of variants. We do one with maple syrup. We do one that's like kind of like a mulled cider called Wassail Wooden Sleeper in the wintertime that you could serve warm. So that's a fun project. That's kind of like its own thing. We keep it over there in one of our barns. And then in another barn, which we call the Stone Barn, it's actually built of stone of the orchard, which was pretty cool. We bought the property. That this was a barn that was there when they first started farming there, like 80 or so years ago. They dug up the ground to plant the trees, and they built this barn out of the stone they pulled up. So it has a lot of history to it, which is cool. So in there, we've got a lot of fooders. American Fooder Crafters, or Fooder Crafters of America, in St. Louis, they just built us a system that's, what is it, 6 across and then 5 above. They're 750 gallons-ish. I can't say that in barrels, but you could probably figure it out. And that's all natural fermentation, wild fermentation. We've got a series of used French oak fooders that used to be in that actually used to be in France. They were used to age cognac and armagnac, and so in all of those cases it's all natural fermentation. We don't ever pitch yeast in that cellar. And so for me, that's like the pride of the project, is what's in that room. And so if anyone out there does get a chance to come visit, it's a pretty special place to get to taste some really cool, you know, naturally fermented ciders. And then we have one other program. We make a cider that's in homage to the cider of Spain, which is probably like the pinnacle of cider, at least from like a cultural standpoint. When you go to Asturias, Spain, it's like the motherland of cider. They drink more cider there per capita than anywhere in the world, in just this one little part of Spain. And it's a place where everyone knows England drinks a lot of cider. And you can go to England and you can drink a lot of cider, but there's not really, the cider culture is relatively new. People just get pissed on cider. And there's a growing group of cider makers in the UK that are elevating beyond that and creating a cider culture. But Spain has a cider culture that goes back centuries. And it's very sort of, you know, it isn't that well known, but when you go there, it's everywhere. It's everything. It's a part of every meal. And so as a cider maker, it's just like, I used transcendent before, but I'll use it again. When I go there, I have a hard time keeping it together. I have a hard time even talking about it. It's a very emotional place for me. And so I've been trying to replicate the cider that they make there my whole career. And I've failed over and over and over again. I have, in fact, had a mentor of mine drink the cider and spit it on my feet while in Spain and say, this has nothing to do with Spanish cider. This is shit. But over the last couple of years, we've really been able to refine it. And we've gotten to a point where, like, I believe, and I've had my Spanish cider making compatriots taste and be like, this is it. You've gotten it there. And so that's one other program we have. We do just a small amount of it every year. It's in its own little room. It's 100% fermented in oak. No pitch at all, no temperature control except the cold of outside, and goes through full malolactic. It's served still and dry. It's, I would say it's a connoisseur level cider, not for your average drinker, but to me it's everything. So if I could just make one cider for the rest of my life, it would be that cider.
Well, next time some homebrewer brings me a beer, I'm going to spit it. No matter how good it is,
yeah,
I'm just going to spit it on his shoes and say, yeah, like,
this is shit.
This is shit.
Hey, I mean, you know, it's good to get a kick in the
ass. There must be some Spanish phrase I can use after that, too. You know, yeah. Totally leave him wondering.
Merde, yeah.
What's the weirdest cider you've ever made?
Well, probably the weirdest cider I made is back in my Michigan Virtue days. Seth Bove, who's the cider maker there now, who we worked together back then, we decided that at Halloween time we would, because everyone's making pumpkin whatever, and we definitely like eschewed anything that wasn't made 100% from apples. We were like, no way, we're not into it. And you know, I sort of softened to that over time, but back then I was very like about anything. If it wasn't apples or pears, it didn't go in the cider, period. And if you do that, like, sacrilege. So we, as sort of a joke slash like needing to do something cool for the tap room, decided to hollow out a massive pumpkin and use that as our fermentation tank. And we fermented a cider in the pumpkin, and then tapped said pumpkin for the cider once it was finished to make a pumpkin cider.
Nice.
As you might imagine, it was awful.
Yeah, you would think you'd get some weird flavors. I imagine it probably works better with like a stout or something like that, where you've got enough bold flavors, and maybe you could, you know, toast the inside of the pumpkin to kind of caramelize the sugars a little bit.
Well, if someone wants to try it, I'm down to taste it.
sounds fascinating.
Have you ever used maple in cider?
Yeah. So the Wooden Sleeper that I was telling you about, the bourbon barrel aged stuff, we do, there's a maple syrup producer here in the Hudson Valley called Crown Maple, and we do a collaboration with them every year where they do a bourbon barrel aged maple syrup.
Okay.
And so we work with them on the bourbon barrels, and then ultimately, so we'll age the cider in bourbon barrel aged, I'm sorry, we'll age the cider in bourbon barrels that had previously held maple syrup. Okay. And then we will add maple syrup back to it also. And it is quite sweet, but sort of sits in like a Madeira space. Okay. And I actually really like the, you know, like I said, the program is very like micro oxidation. So you get these kind of sherry characters. So actually, the sweetness from the maple syrup really lends a sort of cool, some cool body and character to an otherwise dry cider. And it really, I wouldn't drink a pint glass of it, but people do. It's like 13% alcohol. It's real sweet. And in fact, when we do like a, you know, Maple Wooden Sleeper release day, it's like our one cider that, people, you know, we sell out of it the day we release it. People are there in the morning waiting in line. I've been trying to get that kind of excitement around cider the same way beer has for years. It's really difficult. Where I live in Beacon, New York, the Hudson Valley Brewery is here. And it doesn't matter what they released. There's a line starting the night before to buy their cans and their bottles. It's just like nuts. It's 2020 going in 2021, and that's still happening. You know, and I come from, you know, I got into this industry in Chicago when Bourbon County Stout was the thing that you would wait in line for back when you had to. You know, people would line up at Binny's, and people would be chasing the distribution truck down the road to get their hands on one bottle, you know? And I was one of those guys. I would have done anything for those beers back then. And now I can't, you know, they're everywhere, but that speaks to a very good beer. You know, I've been trying to bring that, get that thing in the cider world. And it's been hard to do. This is one of those things that has worked, is this bourbon barrel aged maple syrup thing. And we throw this party around it. But when we sell it with a little bottle of bourbon barrel aged maple syrup from Crown Maple. And people will take the cider, pour it in, and then pour the maple syrup into it that's already had maple syrup poured into it, and then drink it. And they love it. It's a little too sweet for me, but if that's how you want to enjoy it.
People like sweet.
Yeah.
Andrew, one last question. Andrew has asked, have you played with keeving?
Yes.
I have no idea what keeving is.
How much time do we have?
Well, first off, what is keeving?
Yeah. So, even that is a difficult question. I will simplify it to the best of my ability. Keeving is a process to retain natural sugar in a cider while also having natural carbonation in said cider. So if you've drunk a French cider before, you most likely have had a keeved cider. Mm. And so to quickly answer that question, yes, we keeve every year. Not a lot. It's a lot of work with a pretty high failure rate. And it's also extremely cost inefficient. So it is it's an antiquated process to achieve something that you can achieve in other ways. But more or less what you are doing is creating an environment where your pectin and other nutrients, nitrogen, etc., in the cider coagulates, and that's called the chapeau brun. It means brown mushroom or brown hat in French. It coagulates and sort of rises up through the cider via the carbonation, you know, the bubbles that are happening through fermentation. It kind of rises up to the top. They call the brown hat. It sits up on the top. And then you rack your cider out from underneath it. In that mass is a lot of nitrogen, a lot of nutrient, and pectin, right? And so it kind of clarifies and also slows the fermentation down. So when you rack it, you have a disadvantaged cider. And if you get it to happen again, a mass floats up, you strip even more out, then you have an even more disadvantaged cider. And I mean disadvantage versus against fermentation. So each time you do it, you're slowing that fermentation down another step. And the goal is to get to a point where you bottle that cider and it will finish. Well, it will continue to ferment and then die because the yeast is so weak that you retain natural sugar and get natural carbonation in the cider. That can work. It often does not. And that's when you get either a completely dry cider in the bottle that's not supposed to be dry, or you get a very overly carbonated cider with a cork and cage on it. And, you know, you get a gusher, which if you drink enough French cider, you're going to find a lot of. But when done well, which is hard, when done well, it's a beautiful thing. And it's nice to retain that natural apple sugar and get that natural carbonation because those bubbles are very fine and sort of champagne-like. So I love a keeved cider. We do it sort of out of sheer nerdiness because honestly, it takes so much time, which we've got time. You lose so much cider when you do that. And when we do it, I'm not gonna do it with like Macintosh. I'm gonna do it with traditional cider apples. Now, traditional cider apples are hard to come by, they're expensive, and if I'm gonna lose 30% of my fermentation to keeving, I got a hard time justifying that on the other side in the bottle, right? The most you can pay for a cider generally, you know, is he can't really spend much more than $30 on cider. You know, we have some things that are like $35 and $40. That's usually like an ice cider or something that, you know, we age for some crazy amount of time and has some nut story that we brought cider in from England and blended it and blah, blah, blah. Right. But we have to work so hard to break that as an industry, to break that $30 price point that
the story of the brown mushroom is not going to push that, I think.
You know, no, exactly.
You gotta have a better story than a brown mushroom.
Well, yeah. I mean, here I am trying to explain it to you. Like, how long has it took me, like, taken me to even like explain it in a way that makes?
Yeah, you can't write that on a bottle label.
You can't write it on a bottle label. You can't tell. You can't really tell a drinker about it unless we're in a forum like this. Like, people coming through the tasting room couldn't care less, or they don't understand it at all. Most cider makers don't even understand it. So.
Well, it sounds like the pellicle from a bacterial fermentation.
The brown mushroom.
Yeah.
Well, you're inducing it. You want this to happen. So you can add, there's like a keeving kit you can buy online, and you add it essentially will coagulate what you need coagulated, and then you dispose of it and move forward. At the same time, you know, I can ferment a cider. I can arrest the fermentation of the cider with cold or filtration. I can lose, instead of 40% or 30%, I can lose 5%.
Yeah.
I can bottle it and get my cider to re-ferment in the bottle and get the fermentation to arrest in the bottle. And I can get, I've yet to do this. This is one, because it's not that I'm opposed to keeving. It's always a thing that comes up and it's fun to talk about. What I need to do is I need to do the same fermentation right next to each other with the exact same apples. I need to keeve one tank. I need to arrest the other tank with cold and take it all the way through to the end to packaging, and then put those ciders in front of myself and see if I can pick out which one was keeved and which one.
Right.
And I think, I don't know, but I think I won't be able to tell the difference.
Right. Okay. It's a lot of times, you know, it's things like, you know, decoction mashing and just a ton of other things. That,
so do
you know,
it.
It's cool. It's romantic. It's,
yeah,
you know, it's fun to do as a home brewer, but, you know, it's just impractical.
I mean, we do it. I would never discourage it. We do it every single year out of deference to the French. You know, I love it, and I enjoy to drink those ciders that have been keeved. So if you want to put the work in, more power to you.
Very cool. I'm really looking forward to getting those samples. And then Ryan kindly sent some samples out for John and I. Unfortunately, they did not arrive in time for the show, but that isn't going to stop us from drinking them and enjoying them. So
yeah,
thank you very much.
Yeah,
should do a follow-up call with him.
And that would be awesome. I would love it. And, you know, hopefully some of your listeners, you know about the project and know what we've been working on. And one of the problems we have with it is it's not readily available. You generally have to come and visit us, or there's a few restaurants around the country that, you know, the chef or owner we're friends with, and we send it out there. For instance, in Detroit at Mabel Gray, we always have cider that we make in New York, at his restaurant, at James's restaurant there. So there's a few places that you can drink it if you don't get the chance to come to Walden. If I can give one shameless plug, which is not my style, but something that I'm super psyched about, because I want people to drink the cider. It matters to me. I put a ton of heart and soul into it, and I think it's really good. And I want people to have great experiences with cider. After 5 years, we've been trying to get a cider club together where we can ship cider. For the first time starting in February, we're gonna have that. So the details will be coming on our website or social media or whatever. If it is something that people are interested in, they do want to get their hands on it, we're finally gonna have an opportunity to like get it out to, you know, whatever the, I think it's like 30 odd states that we can ship to. So I'm really psyched about it. And it'll be a fun way for people to connect on what we're doing there.
Yeah, that's great. I'm looking forward to it. I know a lot of our listeners are as well. Thank you very much, Ryan, for spending your time with us. We know you're busy and you've got the some keeving to do and you know, a lot of other things to do to keep things going. Thanks again to our fine sponsors, Blickman Engineering. Check them out, blickmanengineering.com. And if you're ever out in the Reno area, check out Brew Chatter. Great folks there as well. Let's see. If you're listening live, stay tuned. John and I will do a live Q&A show and answer your questions from emails as well as live on Facebook. But until then, everybody, brew strong.
Brew strong, everyone.